What's the most expensive thing about marriage? The license? Well, of course, no matter how modest your nuptial celebrations, you will have to pay for that. Or the ring, perhaps. That can set you back a bit, even if it's only 9 carats. And then there's the reception, of course. Now, that really does put a dent in the bank balance, especially if you have champagne and the works. And what about the honeymoon? Be it a 5-star hotel on the Riviera or a self-catering chalet at Clacton, it's going to cost you something. And then there's the photographer to think about, and the bride's dress, and the bridesmaid's dresses, the flowers, the hire of the white Rolls Royce, and of course the ministers. See, not that that's much trouble to anybody. No, there's no getting away from it. Marriage is an expensive business. In fact, it's just as well that in our Western culture we no longer demand dowries and bride prices. But if parents did, one suspects elopement would be an economic necessity for many young couples. And yet, you know, with all the financial implications of these things, I don't believe that any of the things I've mentioned so far are really the most expensive thing about marriage. Shall I tell you what I think is the most expensive? The most pricey thing of all is the promises. For better, for worse. For richer, for poorer. In sickness and in health. To love and to cherish. Till death us do part. That's a really expensive item, isn't it? Indeed, it almost defies valuation. Because there's no limit to what that undertaking might cost us, should circumstances so determine. Who knows what future disaster may await? What illness? What destitution? What tragedy? What loss? And yet when we take marital vows, we are binding ourselves unconditionally and irrevocably to the fortunes of somebody else. Whatever fate befalls them, befalls us too. And for all that we may hope that that is going to bring us inestimable joint blessings, if we're realistic, we have to face the fact that it may also bring us immeasurable joint suffering. For better, for worse, says the wise old prayer book. And that ambiguity of consequence is not only true of the marriage of a man and woman, it's true also of the marriage of Christ and the Christian. If you were with us last Sunday, you'll perhaps remember we were looking at the nature of the relationship between Christ and the church, as Jesus depicts it in a most striking metaphor. I am the vine, he says. You are the branches. It's an extraordinarily intimate picture, isn't it? Because, of course, a vine is its branches, and the branches are the vine. In a sense, you can't distinguish the two. Jesus, in using that metaphor, is affirming a spiritual bond with his disciples, so close, so interpenetrating, it almost amounts to a complete fusion of identity. Remain in me, he says, and I shall remain in you. And bearing that in mind, it's little wonder that when Paul the Apostle wanted to speak about the same truth, he felt it was quite appropriate to use the analogy of marriage to communicate it. For this reason, he says, a man leaves a father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, he says. But I take it to apply to Christ and the church, for we are members of his body. There's an organic union, then, that fuses the Christian to his master. And just as a couple who marry must accept the fact that by virtue of their union to one another, their destinies are locked in tandem, for good or ill, for better, for worse. So the Christian must accept that by virtue of his union with Christ, he must expect to go through whatever Christ went through. If the vine prospers, so do its branches. If the vine suffers, so do its branches. In this second half of John 15, Jesus is spelling out the implications of that for his disciples, stressing repeatedly the parallel between his experience and theirs. Again and again you find the same logic. If such and such a thing is true of me, he says, then the precisely parallel thing is going to be true of you. There is a mutuality about our relationship. You're joined to me. For better, for worse. So you see, if it's an expensive thing to get married, you better believe me when I say it's an expensive thing too to become a Christian. Not because of any money involved, but because of the commitment involved. That's why Jesus so solemnly warns all would-be disciples to count the cost. I carry a cross, he says, and those who are joined to me can expect no better than to carry one also. Well, this morning we are going to look at this demanding correlation that links the experience of the Christian and Christ, as Jesus outlines it for us in this passage. We're going to look first of all at the positive side, the benefits that come to us from being married to Jesus, if you like, in this intimate way, the things that are for the better. But then we have to, because Jesus insists upon it, we have to look at the negative side too. The demands that are upon us by virtue of our being joined to Jesus in this way. The things that are for the worse. At the end of our study, I do hope we shall feel that discipleship, like marriage, is well worthwhile. But I also hope that, like the old prayer book says, we shall realize how important it is not to enter into that contract with Jesus lightly, wantonly, unadvisedly, but rather soberly, reverently, and in the fear of God. Let's start then with the positives. The positives, the benefits that flow out of our union with Jesus. And they're twofold, says Jesus. The first you find in verse 9. The Christian is a recipient of a great love. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. You know, one of the saddest things about this modern world is that scientific advance is killing the poetry in our lives. More and more we see ourselves as machines, bundles of atoms and molecules, reacting according to physical laws, don't we? The thoughts of our minds, well, they're just electric currents in the brain, of course. The feelings of our hearts, well, they're just chemical secretions from our glands, of course. It was bad enough when the scientists used to tell us we were just sophisticated animals. Now they go even further and tell us we're just sophisticated computers. And the more we engage in spare part surgery and test tube fertilization and the like, the easier it is going to be to surrender to that conclusion. And the harder it is going to be to write poetry. Because poets are notoriously romantic, aren't they? They want to talk about love. The 20th century mechanistic biology kills the vocabulary of love. When Romeo in 1984 tells his Juliet that he loves her, he must understand that what he really means by that statement is that the young lady in question excites his cerebral neurons in a particular way. Or stimulates his sex hormones, perhaps. Love in our materialist philosophy is just a sentimental label we place on certain behavioral responses, all of which have a mechanical origin in body chemistry. In other words, there's no essential difference between falling in love and a knee-jerk reaction when somebody hits your leg with a hammer. It's very hard to wax poetic about knee-jerks. Well, thank God the Bible tells us something else. The Bible tells us, contrary to all this scientific mythology of our 20th century, that love is real. Love is a quality adhering in the ultimate truth behind the universe. Before the world was made, there within the mysterious interpersonal structure of divinity, love burned. The Father loved me. Eternal, unquenchable, divine love. Love between God the Father and God the Son. What nonsense, then, to say love is merely a phenomenon of body metabolism. You might as well say Shakespeare is just paper with printing. Has our scientific funnel vision really so blinkered us we can now only believe in things we measure in laboratories? If so, then for all our scientific developments, ancient civilizations were infinitely more advanced than ours is. And the primitive barbarisms of the past we scorn are nothing compared to the technocratic barbarisms of the future we're going to create. Now, human love is enormously significant. It's enormously important because it's a reflection of a divine attribute of everything which is true about us human beings. Love is the most important and noble and dignified thing. It's the most essential component of the image of God within us. For God is love. And that's the first reason that the lot of the Christian disciple is so enviable. That divine love, of which all human loves are but pale echoes, have been bestowed upon him. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. In this mutuality that comes from being joined to Christ, we, like him, become the recipient of divine love. Can you imagine that? All that divine energy of love that flows between the persons of the Trinity, focused, rechanneled through Christ, like rays of the sun through a lens, onto us, onto you and me. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Maybe there's somebody here this morning who feels emotionally deprived. Maybe your childhood wasn't a happy one, and the shadow of that unhappiness still haunts you, even now, years later. Maybe you're single, and you see no prospect of finding a partner. Maybe you're childless, and you look with inner envy at all those happy couples bouncing infants on their knees. Maybe you're divorced or widowed. And there's a great aching vacuum of loneliness and loss inside you as a result. Thousands of people today walking our streets consumed with inner misery because they feel unloved. But you see, no Christian really needs to be numbered among them. Even though the world feels like a desert around about us, Jesus says to us, I have loved you. As the Father loved me, I've loved you. If you haven't found the consolation of that love yet, I urge you to seek it. Because there is no love of parent or husband or child or friend that can compare with it. His love is not fragile and fickle like human affection so often proves to be. It's unchanging. It's utterly dependable. It's the character of God. Here's the first benefit of being joined to Jesus, then, in this marriage of the vine and the branches. We are the recipients of a great love. And there's a second benefit too, if you look. You'll find it in verse 15. The Christian is the recipient too of a great privilege. I no longer call you servants because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I've made known to you. Now, friendship, of course, is something that is poorly understood today. Often it's mistaken for mere acquaintance. Let me introduce you to a friend of mine, we say, when what we really mean is, I've come across this chap before, let me tell you his name before I forget it. But of course, real friendship is much deeper than that. True friendship is a privilege. It's a privilege for two reasons. Firstly, because true friendship is always something we elect to engage in voluntarily. Someone puts it, God gives us relatives. Thank God we can choose our friends. It may sound a bit cynical, but it is true. That element of voluntary selection is vital to friendship. There is, as C.S. Lewis puts it in his book, The Four Loves, an exquisite arbitrariness about it. I have no duty to be anyone's friend, and no one in the world has a duty to be mine. And that surely is why Christ goes on to make that powerful statement of verse 16. You did not choose me, but I chose you. This friendship lies in his initiative. He doesn't owe us his friendship. He gives it to us as an act of free and generous grace. It's a privilege. But not only is it a privilege because it's something Christ elects to engage in with us, this friendship. It's a privilege, secondly, because friendship involves a sharing of confidences. There can be no real friendship without that, can there? Without an unveiling of mind and heart. Our thoughts, our plans, our feelings, our ambitions. We may not wear them on our arm and declare them all and sundry, but we have to be willing to express them to our friends. There can be no secrets between real friends. Jesus experienced just such an intimacy, just such a friendship with the Father. As he told us back in chapter 5, the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. There were no secrets between them. And that's why he can speak here in verse 15 of everything I learned from my Father. When he says everything, he means everything. But here's the extraordinary thing. Here's the miracle. Here's the second reason why a Christian disciple's position is so blessed. That same intimacy which Christ has with the Father is again funneled through Christ to the Christian. I no longer call you servants, I call you friends, for everything I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Isn't that extraordinary? Just as Christ experienced unlimited enjoyment of God's love and passes that on to those who are joined to him, so Christ experienced unfettered access to God's mind and passes that on to those who are joined to him too. So he says you aren't in the position of a slave who must mindlessly carry out instructions. We are friends. I've given you insight into the divine purpose. It's your role not just to be a spectator of God's plans, still less a pawn in them. You are a participant. You are a collaborator. You're a friend. And out of that friendship, two great assurances emerge in verse 16, don't they? First of all, the assurance of effectiveness in Christian mission. I chose you to go and bear fruit, he says. Fruit that will last. There is a subtlety in that text which is missed in translation. Because one of the words Jesus uses there for choose is the same word he used back in verse 13 for laying down his life. The Greek word has that additional meaning of ordain or decree, just like we might talk of laying down the law. I have ordained you, he says. I have laid it down for you. And again, the word he uses for go in verse 16, to go and bear fruit, is precisely the same word he uses repeatedly in this whole discourse for his going away to the Father. Well, that's a very unexpected choice of vocabulary on John's part, and it's a subtle way of re-emphasizing the way in which the mission of the Christian is just an echo of the mission of Christ. As he was involved in the purposes of God, so are we. And that's why we're going to be effective. That's why the fruit will last. But we're not engaged in spiritual guesswork any more than Jesus was. He went to the cross, he laid down his life, he went to the Father voluntarily, understanding its significance. And in the same way, he calls us to cooperate intelligently and effectively with the eternal purpose. You will bear fruit, he says. Fruit that will last. Well, not only out of that friendship comes effectiveness in Christian mission, something else comes out of it too in verse 16, doesn't it? Effectiveness in Christian prayer. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask, in my name. Just as we said last week when we encountered a similar promise back in verse 7. To interpret Jesus here as giving us carte blanche to pray for anything we like in the confidence we will certainly get it is lunatic, isn't it? The whole point of Christian prayer is that it revolves around that central clause of the Lord's Prayer. Thy will be done. Thy kingdom come. Properly understood, Christian prayer isn't an exercise in manipulating God to fulfill our purposes. Christian prayer is an exercise in fellowship with God to fulfill His purposes. Thy will be done. And that being said, of course, the secret of effective praying is knowing God's will. And it is precisely the privilege of being a Christian, says Jesus, that as a friend of His, we do indeed have insight in this matter. Though our prayers may often be foolish and ill-informed, they don't have to be. God doesn't want them to be. He wants us as friends to understand what He's up to and to pray accordingly, so that whatever we ask in Christ's name, He may give it to us. There's a classic example of this in the Old Testament. I wonder if you'll remember it. It occurs in Genesis 18, when God is about to destroy Sodom. And we read that Abraham stood before God and prayed for Sodom. It's rather amusing in some ways. It's a bit like a Dutch auction. He starts off by saying, if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom, will you let it off? And when God says yes to that, he knocks God down successfully from 50 down to 10 righteous people in Sodom. In that long debate, we can't really imagine the end was ever in doubt. God knew precisely how many righteous people there were in Sodom, and he'd already determined that judgment would fall. So what's the explanation of this extraordinary negotiation with Abraham over the matter? Well, the clue is in Genesis 18, if you look it up, where God says, before he even goes to Abraham for this interaction, he says, I will not hide from Abraham what I'm going to do. See the significance of that? I will not hide from Abraham what I'm going to do. Why not? Because Abraham was the friend of God. That's why. That was his title. The friend of God. And this act of intercession deepened that mutual understanding. It demonstrated the gracious way in which God wanted to involve Abraham in his purposes. Rather than simply go and destroy Sodom without saying a word about it to Abraham, he shares his thoughts with his friend. In prayer, they work it through together. That's what it's about. Effective mission, effective praying. Maybe someone here this morning is feeling their life is a bit pointless. Perhaps you failed an exam or a job interview, and now your career ambition seems denied you. Or perhaps if you're honest, you've never really succeeded at much at anything, and inferiority feelings nag perpetually at your self-confidence. Perhaps you've even gone as far as toying with the thought of suicide because you sometimes feel so useless. There are many people I've met in the world like that, utterly tormented with such a low sense of self-worth, they're in a state of permanent depression about it. But you see, there can be no grounds for such thoughts in a Christian. Jesus wants to encourage us out of such negative thoughts. If you're a Christian, if you're my disciple, he says, you must understand what a privileged person you are. You are a friend, a personal friend of the Son of God. He's chosen to have that relationship with you. He's opened up his mind to you. Things hidden from angels from the foundation of the world, says the apostle, have been made known to us. Of course, we don't know all the details. Jesus isn't suggesting Christians are omniscient. But we know enough of God's plan to work and pray intelligently and effectively for its accomplishment. That's what we're here for. That's why he sends us into the world. Why, the Apostle Paul could even call himself a fellow worker with God. There's an Arminian text, if ever there was one. A fellow worker with God, but it's in the Bible. Think of the condescension of that. The Creator of the universe should call us not slaves, not even apprentices, but partners, confidants, friends. Maybe some of you at the end of the service are going to be badgering Chris Catherwood to sign his name in that book he's written. And I know what you're going to do next week. You're going to go waving it around all your friends, and you'll say, "Ha, this chap's a friend of mine, you know." Well, if you get a little bit of pride out of owning a book with the author's name in the front and reflecting on the fact that you're his friend, this evening go out and look at the stars and reflect that you're a personal friend of the one who made them. That's a privilege. A great love, a great privilege. And I guess if that's all that was involved in our choice to follow Christ and be joined to him, then that choice would be an easy and an inexpensive one, wouldn't it? But unfortunately, it's not so. For our union with Jesus is not only for the better, it may be for the worse. And Jesus is honest enough to confront us with that realism. He doesn't want us joining him under false pretenses, bribed by such good things as we've been talking about, and closing our eyes to the small print in the contract. There is a cost involved in being joined to Jesus too. And now we must think about that. That cost also is twofold. The first aspect of it you find in verses 12 to 13. The Christian disciple is called to sacrificial obedience. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. There's a debate today, isn't there, about whether brides should promise to obey or not. It offends our modern minds a little. Love surely should be a totally symmetric relationship, we say, in which neither party claims authority over the other. Well, I'm certainly not going to express an opinion about that. But whether it's contrary to the egalitarian spirit of our age or not, as far as our marriage with Jesus is concerned, the obey stays in. Reckon on that. He insists that without an attitude of obedience, our love for him cannot survive. If we want to maintain that intimacy of which we've been speaking, then we must submit to his rule, and submitting to his rule means submitting to his rules. Look what he says in verse 10. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love. Now, of course, there are some Christians who fail to grasp this and get themselves into all kinds of tangles as a result. They conceive of loving Jesus as, frankly, rather sentimental. It has to do with how intense they feel devotionally when they're praying or worshipping. The whole idea of a code of behavior that Jesus expects us to follow is foreign to their understanding of Christianity. Christ calls us to spontaneity, they say, not legalism. It's much more spiritual to just do as you feel led rather than think in terms of obeying rules. Nothing's more spiritually deadening than a list of thou shalts and thou shalt nots. Augustine had it right, didn't he, when he said, love God and do as you please. That's it. Well, Jesus doesn't agree. Not at least unless we understand loving God, as Augustine did, with a very strong component of Bible-centered moral obligation within it. Undoubtedly, there is an obsession with do's and don'ts, which is alien to Christian freedom. I'm not denying that. But it's a total mistake to think that because Jesus wasn't a Pharisee, he therefore had no place for moral imperatives generally. On the contrary, his teaching is full of commands. And he commends their obedience to us here because he had personally proven the importance of such obedience. Look at verse 10 again. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. You see, it's that parallel again, that mutuality, The Father loved Christ, and Christ's response was surrender to the Father's commands. So Christ loves us, and our response must be surrender to his commands. It's all a consequence of being tied up like a branch in the vine with the experience of our master. Therefore, we can't opt out of obedience unless we care to opt out of him. Indeed, if we had any sense, we wouldn't want to. For obedience to his commands, far from being a recipe for woodenness and frigidity in our spiritual life, is in fact the pathway to true happiness and satisfaction. Look at verse 11. I've told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. Jesus himself had proven that allowing his life to be molded and shaped by the commands of God his Father had brought him joy. And he was convinced this was the way for those who were joined to him to experience the same joy. There's a story, you know, of a mother who heard an ominous silence from the nursery one day and shouted to her husband, George, find out what those children are doing and make them stop. And that's the image, I'm afraid, lots of people have of God as a kind of heavenly spoil sport. He's forever finding out what we're doing and saying no, ruining our fun, destroying our freedom, like a censorious parent. It isn't so. He's concerned for our joy. But joy for us human beings comes through obedience. There is no joy for sinners. The unhappiest person in this world is a sinful Christian. Reckon on it. Obedience is what we were made for. Christ was the most fulfilled human being that has ever walked this earth. And fulfillment for him, he says, came through submission to the Father's commandments. He gives us his commandments to obey them, precisely because he wants his joy to be ours. Is there somebody perhaps here this morning who became a Christian some time ago and you're conscious of some decline in your sense of Christ's nearness? Like William Cooper in that hymn that's in our hymn book somewhere, where is the blessedness I knew when first I knew the Lord? Is that the question that's in your mind? Well, of course, there are several possible reasons for that kind of spiritual barrenness in our lives. And not all of them are necessarily our own fault. It's important we realize that. Sometimes such feelings of desertion are part of God's discipline. That pruning of the vine we were talking about last week. Nevertheless, when we go through times like that, it is important that we ask ourselves very seriously whether there is disobedience in our lives. Because if we are flouting the commands of Christ, we have no right to expect a sense of his presence in our lives, do we? If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love. That's what he says. And that, of course, is why many who embrace this rather sentimental notion of what it means to love Christ to the neglect of moral issues often have great difficulty in sustaining any sense of Christian assurance. Christ said anger was as culpable as murder. He said lust was as sordid as adultery. He said we must speak the truth, that we must eschew revenge, that we must love our enemies. He told us that we must lay up treasure in heaven and not set our hearts on material wealth. He told us we must beware of criticizing people and be humble in our attitudes and avoid exhibitionist piety. He said we were to be generous with our money, compassionate to the poor, persistent in prayer, zealous in evangelism. Those are his commands. And if we're not doing them, then it ought not to surprise us that we do not feel his joy or his love in our lives as we would like. And let's be quite frank about it. Such obedience can be very costly. Look again at verse 12. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Have you ever come across the sort of married or engaged couple who are so obsessed with one another, there's no room in their lives for anybody else? Some ways, I'm afraid, the privatized world of the 20th century rather encourages that kind of social introversion. There was a song that the Seekers used to sing about 15 years ago that some of you may remember. We'll build a world of our own that no one else can share, it began. I fear that's precisely the ambition of many couples today. Not so much the nuclear family as the insular family. Well, that is not Jesus' vision for a Christian society, is it? This is my command. Love each other, he says. You must find room in your life for people. That is the central command out of which all other commands of mine derive. Love each other, he says, as I have loved you. Just think for a moment, will you, of someone who's sitting near you. Don't look at them, that will embarrass them. But think of somebody who's sitting near you, not a relative, a friend, perhaps, a Christian friend. Now tell me, how much do you really think you love them? How much would you give up for their sake? If they were redundant and needed a tenner to pay the rent, would you give it to them? If they were homeless and needed a place to sleep tonight, would you give it them? If they were deeply depressed and needed somebody to companion them and to talk to them into the long hours of the night tonight, would you give them that time? Suppose they were seriously ill and needed a kidney to heal them, your kidney. Would you donate it? Suppose they were in desperate danger and needed someone to put their own lives at risk to rescue them. Would you? Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. Jesus here then is not just calling us to obedience, he's calling us to sacrificial obedience. Obedience that hurts, obedience that costs, obedience for better or for worse. Love for his friends cost him a cross. And each of us, if we would take our relationship with him seriously, must face up to the fact that similar sacrifice may be required of us one day. If Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, says the apostle, we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. That's why I say religious sentimentality is not enough. Being joined to Jesus involves us in a sacrificial obedience. Are you ready for that? Nor is that the end. Jesus says there is another aspect of this cost, this demand of being joined to him. Not just are we called to sacrificial obedience, we are called also to courageous witness. Look at verse 18. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. Now, of course, some Christians are persecuted simply because they ask for it, aren't they? They're objectionable, they're tactless, they're rude, they're arrogant. And when people give them the cold shoulder, they fume with indignation and tell us they're being persecuted for righteousness' sake. Well, of course, they're not. They need to be told. It's their awkwardness, not their righteousness, which is responsible for their suffering. Nevertheless, the warning of Jesus is this, that persecution is natural to a Christian. Even the most gracious and inoffensive Christian, even the most Christ-like Christian, 9 times out of 10, we don't have to invite it. It will just happen.
Notice the four things that Jesus says give rise to this persecution, this opposition from a hostile world. First of all, he says, it happens because Christians are different. Verse 19, if you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you don't belong to the world because I have chosen you out of the world, and that's why the world hates you. H.G. Wells tells the story called The Country of the Blind, about an isolated tribe of congenitally blind people, in which by some strange circumstance a single young man arrives with normal sight. And the story tells how he was regarded as completely mad by the blind population, and how eventually they prescribed the removal of his eyes surgically in order to restore his sanity. It's a brilliant parody of the way that a sick society fails to recognize health even when it stares it in the face. The world hates Christians because they are different. They don't belong. And of course, in that, there is a challenge. For if we do not find ourselves experiencing much of this opposition, could it perhaps be that we're not different enough? Someone said, if tomorrow it were made illegal to be a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict us? The first reason, Christians must expect opposition because they're different. Secondly, says Jesus, they must expect it because men are incorrigibly wicked. They will treat you this way because of my name, he says, verse 21, for they don't know the one who sent me. If I hadn't come and spoken to them, they wouldn't be guilty of sin, but now they have no excuse. If I hadn't come and done among them what nobody else did, they wouldn't be guilty of sin. But now they've seen these miracles and they've hated me and my Father. They've hated me without reason, he says. Incorrigible, you see. It's a solemn thought that the coming of Christ may tragically function so as to actually increase rather than decrease the guilt of some. They might have claimed ignorance before his advent. But now his words and his deeds have fully declared the character of God. Now we know the God before whom each one of us must one day stand. There can be no more excuse, he says. There's no longer a shadow of pretense that we are ignorant. It's a simple case now of contempt of court. The evil of our hearts is totally exposed in all its inveterate viciousness. Now, we must not be utopian about this world. Men are incorrigibly wicked. And that's the second reason the Christian must expect hostility. And the third reason he gives us is this. Because false religion blinds men to the truth. Look at verse 2 in chapter 16. They will put you out of the synagogue. In fact, a time is coming when anyone who kills you will think he is offering service to God. You see the irony there. It's the synagogue they're excommunicated from. It's the service of God that martyrs them. See the implication of that. The church must expect her fiercest opposition, not from the profanity of pagans, but from the fanaticism of pietists. It's religion that persecutes, not irreligion. For irreligion is a blindness of nature, not so much antagonism as indifference. But false religion's blindness is a blindness of choice. Not mere apathy, but antipathy. That's why unpopularity is to be expected. It's to be expected from the world. It's to be expected from the church. Of the world. Isn't that so? Isn't that the way it's worked? Aren't Jesus' words right? It's only a short step from the zealous orthodoxy of the Christian to the blind and ruthless intolerance of the Inquisition. And that short step has been taken. Don't forget they preached a sermon at the burning of Cranmer. It isn't only out of synagogues Christians have been put out, it's out of churches. It isn't only in the name of Allah or even of Jehovah that Christians have been killed. It's in the name of Jesus. That is the appalling irony of persecution. But the third reason that we must, fourth reason we must expect persecution, Jesus says, is quite simply this. Because they persecuted him. If the world hates you, he says, know that it hated me first. The servant is no greater than his master. Ultimately, you see, it comes down to that parallelism we've noted so often. We are caught up in union with one who was despised and rejected of men, he says. And that's why we can expect no better treatment. You remember how Paul, when he was on the Damascus Road, was challenged by Christ. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It's a crazy question. Of course, Saul was persecuting Christians, wasn't he? But then you see in Jesus' mind, it's the same thing. Unpopularity is to be expected. For Christ was unpopular. We must be prepared for it then, and when it happens, he says, our duty is plain. You also must testify, verse 27. You've been with me from the beginning. He's speaking here, of course, particularly to those 11 who were, in a special sense, the eyewitnesses of his ministry, the disciples. But by extension, surely he's speaking to us too. We are called not just to sacrificial obedience within the context of a loving church. We are called to courageous witness in the context of a hostile world. That's what he says. Well, we won't be on our own in that task. The Spirit of Truth will be there, endorsing our testimony in the hearts of those to whom we speak. And some among them will listen to us, just as some listen to Jesus. But there will be others who will revile us, ostracize us, prosecute us, execute us. And down through history, his words have been confirmed over and over again. You know, the old Moravian brethren had a badge. It depicted an ox with a plough on one side and an altar on the other. And the motto in Latin underneath said, ready for either. A plough or the altar. Service or martyrdom. It's to our loss that in this tolerant 20th century we no longer feel that disturbing second alternative. We talk so smugly, don't we, about loving Jesus. But what does it really mean to us? A warm, cozy glow while we sing jolly choruses, most likely. But to love Christ for these 11 to whom Jesus is speaking, for them it meant loss of security, loss of wealth, loss of reputation, loss of freedom, loss even of their very lives. On my count, only about 2 of them went to their beds peacefully in death. Do we love Christ like that? Oh, I know we do a lot of work for the church. But what about when they put us in solitary confinement? Is it Christ we love or Christian fellowship, if the truth were known? Oh, I know we spend a lot of time reading the Bible, but when they take our Bibles away from us, and indeed every other Christian book, is it really Christ we love or Christian theology, if the truth were known? Oh, I know our devotional times are sweet. But what about when they torture our minds and our emotions so much we can hardly think straight, let alone pray? Will it be Christ we love? Or just religious sentimentality? Oh, I know we're willing to knock on a few doors and invite our neighbors to a guest service. But when the noose is hanging over our head and the blindfold is going over our eyes, is it Christ we love? Or life? We have done something in the Western Church which those 11 disciples that Jesus was speaking to would hardly have believed possible. We have made Christianity safe. And in making it safe, we've made it unexciting. And in making it unexciting, we have made it cheap. But real Christianity is far from cheap. Real Christianity is an invitation to the most dangerous adventure the world can offer. Here is a Christ who demands we hazard everything we have and are for his sake. This is a religion for heroes, not hypocrites. For martyrs, not moderates. For soldiers, not sentimentalists. Here is the challenge of Jesus to us today. Ready for either. Service or martyrdom. For better or worse. Are we ready for a marriage like that? Weigh the cost carefully then. Before you take the hand of Jesus and say, I will. Let's pray together.